Powell, real number 6.
Well, it struck me at the time that it was extremely bad form for a playwright to laugh until he cried at his own comedy. And I leant forward to him afterwards, and when it was finished, and I said, "I'm so glad, sir, that you appreciate our poor efforts at your play." He turned round, still wiping his eyes, and he said, "Do you know, if I had thought it was going to be anything like that, I wouldn't have written it."
In addition to this rather exceptional theatre activity of 40 squadrons, how else did you spend your time?
Well, I think it not only 40 squadron, but every RFC squadron, the centre of the squadron seemed to be in the bar. That may offend a lot of people in these days, but it's perfectly true. And when you think of these boys with the tensions they lived through the day, and they came in the evening, and their best friend, "Where's him? I miss old George. Oh, he bought it this afternoon." Oh, heavens. Now the gloom would come into a mist, the morale would die, and the reaction immediately was, "Well, come on, chaps, what are you going to have?" And that is the sort of spirit that kept going. And though people are against alcohol, I still think that it played a magnificent part in keeping up the morale of our troops generally. And I remember one occasion, I used to have a little flask which I filled with rum, and I kept it in my tunic pocket. When I got so bitterly cold in these open aircraft in the winter, with the one's moustache got frozen and a great block of ice appeared there, there was something to keep you going. And I used to open this little flask and just take a nip. And when you're up very, very high, one little drop of alcohol and you feel as though you've been out on a binder. Absolutely glorious. The effect was immediate. And, of course, as you came down, you were as sober as a judge when you'd come down a few thousand feet. That was a thing which I experienced.
How much flying were you doing with 40 Squadron?
Well, the average pilot flew two offensive patrols a day, providing the weather was suitable. And that meant that he did 4 hours a day in the air and actually being shot at for 4 hours, which is quite enough, and the tension was quite considerable. I even found myself like an ostler grooming a horse. I used to fly along going... Well, that must have been just sheer nerves. And remember, at that time, I was only just 20 years old.
But presumably, the weather conditions influenced this amount of flying considerably.
Perfectly, yes. Yes, it did. And on the bad days, that is when it's pouring with rain with a low cloud ceiling, there was no flying. We then used to get into the cars and go off to the various towns, places like Amiens. Nabil was too small, but in a large town, and Saint-Omer, that was good. And that was where most of these boys learnt a little more about life than they would ever have done in normal civil life. Because we used to go to the various estaminets, not very popular, and then every town of any size at all had its house of entertainment, which I believe is called a brothel. And so people gathered, although they were young in years, it wasn't long before they were quite worldly wise men.
Apart from that section of the civilian population for whom you were customers, how did you get on with the main body of the French people you met on these kind of jaunts?
I didn't like them at all, because when I was in 40 Squadron, the mess I was in was a chateau, a beautiful chateau, with wonderful inlaid doors and wonderful chandeliers. It really was a magnificent place. And it belonged to a gentleman who was supposed to be French, but his name was Schatzmann. And Schatzmann tried to discipline us when putting notices all around the hall saying, "Officers will put their hats in the cloakroom and not leave them in the hall." Things like that. Lorraine, of course, spoke the most marvellous French. He could talk idiomatic French. And he and Schotzmann did not see eye to eye. And I'm not surprised, because Schotzmann was so interested in his chateau, he had no thought of us fighting his confounded war for him. And on one occasion, one of our boys, on the aerodrome, which was on Schotzmann's ground, overshot and ran into the cornfield, where he crashed and came out. I was up in the office that morning, and Schotzmann came up, and he said, "Excuse me, Major, I understand you have had an accident. One of your planes has landed in the cornfield." I thought he was being quite decent, and so I said, "Oh, thank you, Mr. Schotzmann, for your inquiry, but the boy wasn't damaged at all." And he said, "I was not thinking of your boy, but about my corn." So you see that Schotzmann was not very popular with us. I'm afraid we damaged his chateau terribly, disgracefully.
We talked about relations between RFC and the French. Any considerations on the subject of relations with German aviators with whom you came into contact?
There was a sort of code, I think, merely between flying people, whether they were German or British. But there was a great comradeship, if you can call it, between them. I had a flight commander who was named Maxwell Pike, and he went up and was shot down in flames, and that was the end of Maxwell Pike. But 2 days afterwards, a German airplane came over, dropped a message back, and told us that the gallant Captain Pike was shot down in mortal combat and has been buried behind our lines with full military honours. That is the sort of esprit de aviator, I suppose you'd say. And that spirit, it held on, I think, to the very end. And I ought to know, because when I was eventually taken prisoner, I met it again in Germany as a prisoner.
Yes. What about this incident with the football?
Ah, yes, another instance was, another example was one of our gallant officers who was flying an FE-2B, flew over on the 1st of April over a German aerodrome, and over he dropped a football, and on the football was printed April the 1st. He just dropped it over and haired back to our lines. One can imagine the terrible sight of this slow-moving bomb coming down from about 5,000 feet, landing on the aerodrome, all the Boche running for cover, waiting for the explosion, and then comes the big bounce when they pick the ball up, and there is April the 1st. That was the sort of, shall I say, friendship that went between the flying people of the two sides.
Now, after you left 40 Squadron, that was in February of 1917, roughly. What appointment did you receive next?
I was posted to Southern Group as chief fighting instructor. At that time, the training home establishment was divided into two groups, North and South. The Southern Group was commanded by General Dowding, the Northern Group by General Herbert. Herbert I knew, and I wanted to get to his group. I applied for the post as Chief Fighting Instructor, Northern Group. And whilst I was at Upavon, Southern Group, I selected and had delivered the aircraft I chose, which was a DH-2.
Was this an aircraft you were familiar with?
Oh, yes.
You've flown it quite a lot.
Oh, yes, I flew it in the 1915. And then I chose this one because it's a very comfortable little aeroplane to fly, a little single-seater. And I had my own aircraft, my own rigger, my own fitter, a motor bicycle and sidecar. And the theory was that as I flew over the group to the various stations, my fitter and rigger would come by road and meet me at the aerodrome wherever I was aiming to get to.
Now, could you explain to me what your responsibility as Chief Fighting Instruction, Chief Fighting Instructor, Northern Group was?
Well, on various, all the training stations, there was one permanent fighting instructor appointed, usually a captain. And my responsibility was to see that these fighting instructors were actually instructing the pupils in the art of fighting, the method of attack, and sort of keeping the sun behind you where possible, always attacking from underneath and behind an aircraft, which was the safest place, and give lectures roughly on how one went into a fight and the things to avoid. And in addition to that, I was supposed to send a report to the to London on the number of hours actual in flying I had done and the instruction given in flying. Well, that part of the training I just could not agree with. It struck me as being so ridiculous to ask a man to instruct a pupil who's standing on the aerodrome in the art of flying. It must, to my mind at that time, it must have been dual control to show him how to approach the aircraft, and then later he would move, say, to another flight, and there he would be taught with another aircraft as to how to approach, and you'd have two aircrafts actually trying to get to fight and shoot each other down. That was what I thought would be better. And it struck me that to just go up and fly about oneself and do a few aerobatics wasn't teaching the pupil on the ground anything at all. And one might just as well expect anybody who paid half a crown at Hendon to watch a flying display to come away from the aerodrome a fully qualified pilot. It meant nothing at all.
Did your failure to send these written reports in have any repercussions?
Well, to a certain extent, I sent in my written reports, which included the number of lectures given by the various instructors. But what I didn't send in was a report on the flying instruction, which is the fighting instruction in the air, and for the reasons I've previously mentioned. And it struck me as being so useless, so I continued to fill that particular part of the report in with the word nil. After a few of these reports had been sent through to the General Headquarters Royal Flying Corps, London, an officer was sent up to me at York to ask why I hadn't sent them in. I then said I would write a full report giving my reasons for not doing so. The reasons I have stated before, which it struck me as being so ludicrous to expect anybody to give instruction in fighting when the pupil is standing on the ground and you're doing aerobatics in the air. I wrote in a full report, as I said I would, describing what I thought ought to have been done, which was to form a special squadron which was for fighting instruction, which would entail, say, three flights of AVROs, dual control, in which the pupils would go from the first flight, where they would learn aerobatics. The second flight they'd posted to, where they would then learn actual fighting instruction with another aircraft, and finally graduate to the final flight, which would be single-seater aircraft, and there they would continue to practice the art of fighting in the air. As a result of that, I found that instead of getting the chop, I was promoted to squadron commander and posted to Turnhill, number 43 squadron.
Before we go on to Turnhill, could I just ask you whether your suggestions regarding this special squadron were taken up?
They were, in a way, in that a special squadron based at Gosport was formed, which was a sort of super-flying instruction was given to fully qualified flying instructors. The advanced flying, one would call it now, was carried out, it was quite difficult. One had to learn how to land side to wind, how to be able to take off downwind, in fact, how to break every rule of flying and still be in control of the aeroplane.
What was the role of the training squadrons?
The training squadrons were supposed to turn out so many pilots per month. And the headquarters, Royal Flying Corps, would ask for so many pilots, say 14 pilots, that is people who qualified and have got their wings, each month. They would base this on the last month's turnover of that same squadron. I managed to gradually build up quite a number of pilots, and I always insisted on giving at least two more than they asked for. I kept quite a number of pilots back for this very reason, that should a month of bad weather come when there was no flying, it would have struck me as being rather useless for the headquarters to ask a squadron for, say, 14 pilots and then be told, well, I'm sorry, bad weather, we haven't any at all. As it was, I allowed for the bad weather, so that when they asked me for 14, despite the fact we'd only had, say, a week's flying in that month, then I was able still to supply the 14. They were sure of getting the number they asked for, plus two, from my unit. And that was the system I worked on.